Succession number 18463, Reel 4.
Dunbar, Reel 4.
Well, recapping, Wednesday, I think I'd come to on the previous reel. By Wednesday, Archie Smallman was sort of hiding from us all because there was no news whatsoever about us going to Korea. But by the following Monday, on the following Monday, they'd all been busy, the CO and the company commanders got it on the Sunday, CO on the Saturday, company commanders on the Sunday, and we got it on the Monday morning. We worked on the Bugle, incidentally, and there was no clocks or anything like that in Hong Kong. Everything was by the Bugle, every mortal thing, guard, half-hour guard, quarter-hour guard, and all the rest of it. And early in the morning, first parade was always, incidentally, a paladrine and saltwater parade. So you had paladrine, two paladrines for anti-malaria, and half a cup of salt water. And if you didn't take it, and you got malaria or what have you, they checked your blood and you were in a little bit of serious trouble. But anyway, on the Monday morning, there wasn't the normal parades. The normal parades didn't come off, and there was obviously something going on. And I guess it probably about 10 o'clock when we were warned that we were for Korea at the end. On the Wednesday, I think it was then, you know, in 3 days' time. Well, they had to put that off because it wasn't time. And immediately what they had to do then was, we hadn't got enough men. There were not enough men in a battalion. So they had to call for, it was said at the time, volunteers, but none of them were volunteers. Well, there might have been a few. The cell staffs, I think, probably were volunteers because they were quite a nice, rugged crowd. The KSLI, their name came up on the board and they were brought forward. And we had cell staffs. I've got a feeling we did have one Cosby, I can't be sure. One or two Leicesters, and mainly KSLI. But this didn't come to the end of the week. Anyway, we start forming then. We were reformed on the Monday into platoons. C Company was disbanded. Support Company was disbanded. And the two, or whatever it would have been, the machine gun platoon, the mortar platoon, the Pioneer Platoon, all came under HQ Company for admin and obviously for operations under Battalion HQ. So there was a great scrimmage. People were, John Shipster unfortunately lost his company and became second in command of B Company, and the OC Support Company, Major Allen, he became a company commander. We didn't know any of the, you know, we knew John Shipster, we didn't know the others. And officers were drafted in. The training platoon, of which we were all rather proud of, you know, and thought we'd all stay together, was on the Monday, was broken up straight away. And we were distributed about in various platoons. I went to 6th platoon with Bill Everett. And John White stayed with 4th platoon. Joe Pentany, that one of the corporals, stayed with 4th platoon. He was he died of wounds and was mentioned in dispatches. And Chris Lawrence stayed as their platoon commander, whilst we had this Austrian or German, whatever, Gus Saunders, Lieutenant Gus Saunders, as our platoon commander. We didn't see much of him because the platoon sergeant was Albert Critchley, and he really organised things, you know. Gus really had very little to do with it. And we had fairly easy days, expecting to go on the Wednesday. They couldn't do that. And by the Wednesday it had gone on, and the platoon was gradually forming. There were new men coming in each day. A lot came from support company, so we had a lot of specialists. What we didn't have was many infantry trained people. You know, they'd been trained in training, but they were now specialists in machine guns and mortars and pioneers and things like that. And gradually by the Thursday, we test fired the weapons into a bank just down the bottom of the camp there, and we were virtually ready on the Thursday night. We had all our kit ready, FSMO, I think we must have probably had a blanket wrapped around the pack. I can't really remember now. And steel helmets, arms had been issued. But the draft from the mainly Chaos Alliance cell staffs arrived, I read now, arrived that night, but they didn't join us. So on the Friday morning, when we're going off down to the ship, we went over to the edge of the MT park, and there in a hut were all the reinforcements, and they joined us then, so we'd never met them at all. And of course, being Chaos Alliance, they had the infantry but so they were getting a bit confused how to move and things like that. So we were literally, I guess, at the very most, we were 37, I should think, between 30 and 37 strong. And a lot of these were specialists. I would hazard a guess, I didn't know more than 4 or 5 of the people in the platoon. So we were literally a bunch of strangers who were waiting over the other side there. And they came and joined us. A few minutes later, we got onto the 3-tonners. That took us down to Fanling Station, where there was a special train waiting for us. Took us down to the wharf there. I can't remember the name of it now. The wharf. Somebody's wharf. And there was the Unicorn and HMS Ceylon waiting for us. Unicorn being the aircraft carrier and Ceylon being the cruiser. Well, the Argyles got the Ceylon and we got the Unicorn. We went up on the under the flight deck, and then we stood on the lifts, went down on the lifts, and down below at the bottom of each lift, a sailor gave you a mattress cover, and you just picked a... Well, you didn't actually just pick a bat. You were put in section lines across the hangar deck, and your bed was this mattress cover, and your pillow was your pack sort of thing, you know. Laid your kit out, and the battalion and the brigade had been told not only to take a minimum of transport. So we only had a few trucks. There was a just near where I was, there was the brigadier's caravan and a carrier and I think a 3-tonner, and I think there was a couple at the back, probably a similar amount of vehicles at the back, a couple of jeeps maybe. I can't remember the jeeps. There must have been jeeps there, I presume. And then whilst we were on the dock, apparently, the order came that all the vehicles should be taken. Unfortunately, of course, all the vehicles had been taken off down to the depot and handed in. So they came on later. They were going to come on later. So we went with virtually nothing. Sailed in the evening to a great reception from people on the shore, waving and bands playing, and, you know, they were getting toilet rolls and throwing them down. It was a wonderful thing. It was quite an exciting thing for youngsters, you know, who really didn't know anything about it. The governor gave us a little pep talk. I have no idea what he said. Though there's a rather a charming story, incidentally, from, I think, either John Shipster or John Willoughby, Major Willoughby. I think it's Major Willoughby, who said that the governor had had a heart attack and his doctor had said to him, "I don't want any more parties and you must stop poking Lo Wu," who apparently was his girlfriend. I got that, incidentally, from the back of a photograph where John Willoughby had written this on the back of the photograph. So he didn't really impress us too much, the governor, I don't think, if we remember anything about it, you know. There's a photograph of us all standing on the deck. Went out to sea, and just outside the harbour, with us and Ceylon, sailed more or less together, and just outside the harbour, two Australian, I guess they must have been destroyers, picked us up. Warramunga was one, I can't remember the name of the other, and we set off with them swooping in and out, you know. It was quite exciting, really. I mean, they were swooping about all over the place, and there was talk of submarines and air attack and things like that, and all the LMG teams, of which I was a number two, you know, a section commander, a 2IC of a section, commanding a light machine gun group, we were set around the ship's side. of pods with all Lick and Cannons in. And in pairs, we were set with a pair of sailors. And we loaded up all the big magazines, which are quite big things, you know, with a big handle. What are we, 20mm all Lick and Cannon things, you see. And the sailors showed us, well, they obviously showed us how to load them. I mean, we didn't need much showing because we were fairly au fait with things like that. And then they showed us how to fire it. And if one of them got injured or killed, you know, we were to take over and things like that. It was quite exciting, really. And it was quite an interesting thing because there was this supposition of air attack. But more important, there was the submarine thing, because it was thought at that time that either North Korea had a couple of submarines or a submarine, or Russia might join in, or China might join in. So there was this sort of air of, excitement about it all. Meals on board ship. We had to go, they only have little galleys. An aircraft carrier is literally an open space at this time. I mean, I know what they are, these modern ones. An open space, and then round the edge are corridors. And along these corridors are little messes, not much bigger than this, perhaps even smaller than this. So we all had different places to go to and at different times to go to. And we had fantastic meals. The sailors really gave us fantastic meals. And washing, again, was another problem. You had to sort of go in sections. And there was one freshwater shower and about six saltwater showers. And then saltwater causes dreadful stuff. You know, you had to have special soap, which we didn't have, and it won't lather. So you could really only just get a bit of a wash down in that. And it all went off reasonably well. You know, you had to shuffle down these corridors and get your meals and things like that. Then in the evening, the crew, not on duty, would walk backward and forward on the deck to get some exercise. And we used to follow them up and down there, you know. At the back of the ship, stern end, naval parlance, there were fighter aircraft, various fighter aircraft, plus an old Walrus float plane tied down on the deck. I think she was actually a ferry, the Unicorn. She wasn't an aircraft carrier per se. She was a ferry which ferried aircraft out to various places. But we could roam the ship, and I mean, not the bridge, of course, but anywhere else you could roam. And I found my way right forward. And in the bow of the ship, there was a great, like an anchor. It wasn't an anchor, but it was a great hawser opening. I guess it was taller than me. It was about 8 foot high. And you could stand in here hanging on and look down. And there was the bow ploughing. Wonderful it was. Fantastic. I couldn't get away from it. You know, this ship was ploughing through and out ahead with these two destroyers weaving in and out of the seas. The seas were quite heavy, you know, breaking over us, and all the anchor chains down the side. It was fabulous. And I was on my own as well. I thought, oh, I fall off. No one will ever know. They won't miss me till they get back from Korea. And eventually it was Formosa then, wasn't it? Isn't it?
Taiwan
now, isn't it? Yes, Formosa. I think we went outside Formosa because there was some problem. If we went between there and China, the Chinese might have got a bit miffed about it. And we went round there, round to Pusan, and got in there in the morning, and it ponged a bit, actually. And the salon went in first, I believe, because the Unicorn was difficult to manage. And we'd all been ordered below, so we were all laid out below on the decks down there, because there was no... I think the officers were up the top, you know. But we were all down below. And, of course, it was the Argyles who got all the attention, you see, because they had guys with kilts up on the... there playing the bagpipes, and the Americans... There was a Negro band. Well, this enormous great Negro drum major, you know, with his white laces and helmets and all the rest of it. But all the press and that went off to the to see the Argyles get off, And I read only just recently an officer writing that they were all a bit miffed because they'd expected them all to be in kilts, you know. And why aren't the rest of you in kilts? You know, you've got trousers on. What's this? And we didn't get a great deal of attention. We came down and in these long sheds, we sat around in these long sheds in company groups, platoon company groups. And civilians there who were, you know, welcoming us and all this sort of business. We weren't terribly interested, I'll be quite honest. You know, I think that our understanding of foreign nationals was perhaps not what it is today. We were, I suspect, in retrospect, we were felt a bit superior to them all, you know. And that wouldn't be surprising because they were a pretty pongy lot, you know. Anyway, we sat around on the ground there, and an officer, I can't remember if he had a badge up, or what regimental badge he had up, but he was a captain in KD, reasonably dirty KD, came among us, and I was absolutely disgusted with him because he was saying, well, you're too late. I don't know why you're landing here. It's all over. The job's finished. You might as well go. And we wouldn't even answer him. We were, you know, I was shocked. I personally was shocked with him, and I didn't see anybody answer him. In fact, we deliberately turned our backs on him, and he went on his way. I don't know who he was, what he was, and I've, matter of fact, I did mention it to Farrah Hockley once to see if he had any idea, but he never came back, so I presume he didn't, or he wouldn't want to anyway. But I wondered, because all the embassy staff had been captured up in Seoul, you know, old Blake and all the rest of them, you know, and had been caught, and I often wondered if he was maybe there on the new embassy staff or something like that. But he was absolutely atrocious, a disgrace to the British Army. He was dirty for a start, you know. All right, so maybe he'd been in some unpleasant situations, but this defeatism was terrible. Anyway, we sat around on the deck in these huts for a while, and the ship sent down big cans of tea, hot tea, and fresh bread and golden syrup. That was the most delicious meal I've ever tasted, I do believe. I couldn't eat it today, golden syrup and bread, but it was absolutely delicious. And sometime later, I thought we all marched off, but apparently D Company stayed to look after the kit bags. There was a delay because the train that we were going to go on was full of fleas, apparently, and lice and things like that. So the Navy rather kindly sent down a team to fumigate it, you know. So by the time we got there, it was all sort of clean and tidy. Well, fumigated would be perhaps a better way. An old train with wooden seats and what have you. We filed aboard, and we were then issued with ammunition and ordered to charge magazines. And I think that perhaps brought it home to everybody, you know, that we're on now. And just on the other side of us was a flat tops with a number of Chaffee tanks on, and Americans sitting all over them, you know, and what have you. They were the light tank, which was no match for the T-34, and they were presumably going up. The train set off. It was a terribly long journey. Slow, rather. I don't know about long so much, but slow journey up through all these paddy fields. And here it's quite interesting because we could see a complete difference between Korea and Hong Kong. The paddy fields in Korea, because they haven't got a great deal of flat ground, are tiered up the sides of the hills to quite an extended height, you know. So this was the difference between Hong Kong and Korea. I don't know whether they had the, because as you think I've probably said, you know, they in Hong Kong it's all human excrement, you know, and they have these great pits, and they have a great stirring thing, you know, and occasionally they break the crust on the top and give it a stir, which is a bit unpleasant. And I don't know if they go in for that in Korea. I think they probably do, because there's a later event which might say that they do that sort of thing. But anyway, it was after dark when we reached Kyongsan, which is a railway station near a what was, in fact, we didn't know it, but it was the 24th Division's reserve area. And we got off the train, and there were enormous, I don't know what they must have been, great stalks, fields full of stalks, and I must admit the first thought was, hello, if there's any snipers in there, we've had it. And we climbed onto American lorries, and they packed us in. So we got FSMO on, you'll appreciate, you know, so we're that round each person sort of thing, you know. They packed us in there so solid, and I was the last one in, and the tail ball was just like the back of my legs. And all I could do, because he went like mad, this driver, was hang on to the equipment of the people, and otherwise we'd have been over the back. I mean, it's the most frightening journey, one of the most frightening journeys I've ever had. And we eventually came to where we turned off the road and went along a narrow stream, and were literally dumped into the ground there. And it was about, by this time, it was about, I guess it must have been at 3 o'clock. And it was terribly cold, really freezing cold. We're in Jungle Green with this one blanket. And we camped down straight away and set the guards, you know. And it was freezing, absolutely freezing cold. You couldn't wait for morning, you know, until the sun came up and warmed you up a little bit. And that was virtually how we had our first night in Korea. Unfortunately, poor old Gus by this time was proving that man management wasn't one of his very good functions. And on about the second day, his batman said to the platoon sergeant, "You better find him a new batman, or you'll have a dead platoon commander." There was a civil retreat all the time. All you could hear all day, this chap's name was Padgett. Padge, we called him. Padgett. Padgett, where's my coffee? Padgett, where's my bed? Padgett, have you cleaned my pistol? And all day long, he never stopped. And he wasn't the most popular platoon commander, I'm afraid, at that time. And anyway, we stayed there. We started doing patrols out over the various countryside, which was quite good, familiarisation of the country that we were just about to see. And we had a lecture, a company lecture, and we were asked the question, company commander put it to us, there's a village over there, there was a village just over the other side there. How are we going to clear it? And by common consent, we all agreed it wasn't possible to clear it. Burn it was the best thing, would be the only answer. If you came to a village, the only answer would be not to clear it. If it's occupied, your best thing is to burn it and then, you know, go around the flanks. And then going off on the patrols, it was quite interesting because there was a road below us on the hills, and there were American lorries coming along there. And they towed a chain behind them. Each one of them towed a chain. The only thing I could think of is that it was to raise dust to give an impression that, you know, this was a regular supply route or something like that. Seemed no other reason for it, because this dust billowed up right above the height of the hills. And on the far hill, there was a little oyster going round and round and round. And then phosphorus shells started to drop in this. Now, quite close to us, you know. Nobody seemed to be too worried about it. But I don't think it was training. I think they must have thought there was somebody there. And also another really interesting thing, the girls in Korea have long hair. When they marry, they cut their hair off and then they keep it as a memento of their wedding day, you see. And, of course, the Americans, drivers, were getting these long lengths of hair out the houses and tying them on their wing mirrors sort of thing. So you had a flowing hair, which I don't think it must have upset the Koreans just a wee bit, you know. But that was how our first introduction to Korea. And my friend Ken Partridge, who was a corporal, and in fact was my section commander at that time, said to me one day, "Do you want to come down and try the flamethrowers?" I said, "Well, we haven't got any stuff on it. Yeah, we can try them with water." He'd been on the pioneer course, and he was a pioneer corporal one time. And we went down to the stream where we'd all had it. We were all bathing and washing and things like that. And we got these, and we had a fantastic time shooting at each other, covering, you know, and getting the sand out of the way, because the water shoots out of them just like a great big toy pistol, you know. They're fantastic, the life buoy, that is, you see. So we had a wonderful time. We were absolutely soaked. We'd only had shorts on, of course, you know. And he said, "Well, we better pack them up now, dry them all out, pack them up." So I said, God, that was great. You know, we'll do that again, Kane, if we're here much longer. He said, no, you won't, he said, because you're now trained flamethrower operator. I said, oh, no. He'd been told to find somebody in the company to train as a flamethrower operator, and he'd chosen me. I wasn't at all pleased with that. As it happened, they were packed up and taken away, and they were never used in our brigade. I believe the 29 Brigade thought about using them, and I think they used them for their tanks, but we never ever used flamethrowers. I never saw them again. But that was my introduction and training course on the Lifebuoy flamethrower. Anyway, we were there till we landed on the 29th, and we were there till the 3rd, and things were going a little bit tricky. The North Koreans were attacking and breaking through, and we started to move up the line on the 3rd of September. And first of all, we went up, northwest of Daegu, and we got there about 11 o'clock at night. It was pouring with rain. We were absolutely saturated with rain, and we were told that we might have to do a night attack up a valley, because a night attack is about the worst thing you can do, especially for your first operation. There was a police post was threatened, apparently, up the top of this valley, and we were supposedly to go down and clear it. As it happened, I think it was a false alarm, because nothing happened. And then at dawn, because in the British Army, because we stand to every morning, hour before first light, and then, or half an hour before first light, half an hour after first light. So that morning, of course, we're all in American transports and no British transport. We all stood to, and these Americans said, what are you doing? Shall we do this every morning? We stand to, you know, armed, all equipment, you know, all ready, loading everything, laying about in the right on the edge of the stream, no water lapping over us and all this other bit. And these Yanks are walking about, absolutely astounded. They said, we don't do this. Well, what's the idea of this? And, of course, apparently in the American Army, they didn't do early morning stand to, which, of course, probably accounted for one or two of their little misdemeanors over the following months. Anyway, that day, I guess, probably about midday, we loaded on the transport again, and we're now off to what was to be our operational area in the bulge of the Nakton River. Passed through Daegu in daylight. Quite amazed by that, because they were the people, the were out washing their clothes and things in the sort of drainage ditches, you know, just shallow drainage ditches. And it was only then we began to notice that the dress of the women in Korea was a sort of little bodice thing, you know, like that. And everything else was bare underneath. And, of course, the lads were saying, whoa, look at that. Within 24 hours, they'd forgotten about it all, you know. But that was their summer dress. They had a white linen bodice. Later, they'd have a shirty thing underneath. And white baggy trousers. Sometimes black. But it was black and white. I can't remember what the mix was. The trousers were definitely white. And I think they had a black something. The men seemed to have a black jacket and trousers. And the women had a sort of like a slipper on, and most of the men had what we eventually began to call gook boots, which were like sand shoes, you know. Anyway, we went off down, and quite a long way, fairly running along the edge of the Nakton, and we could see where the river was on the other side, all empty villages, lush vegetation, and basically the road was built underneath some higher ground, so on what would be the supposedly friendly side, it was fairly high up. Now we stopped off, the whole column stopped off, and 6th Platoon, Gus's platoon, stopped off and stayed on the road until well after dark. Now, we didn't really know why that was, but except, of course, that the road further on was under direct fire.